Professors FM.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the COVID edition of the Fanalytics podcast. Our online home is www.fandomanalytics.com. And as always, we are brought to you by the Marketing Analytics Center. Yes, my colleague, Mr. Doug Battle, just informed me during the intro countdown that he had COVID. Completely irrelevant to what we're talking about this week, unless you want to expand upon that, Doug.
I don't know. The show must go on. And yeah, that's the only comment.
Okay. Okay. So we've been mired in technical difficulties for a while now, but we believe we have everything corrected. So, Doug, why don't we lead off? And I got mixed feelings about this one. You know, I love quarterback talk. You know, it's actually my favorite thing in the whole world of sports at this point is NFL quarterbacks. I think this is like one of the most prominent people in every major city. They're all great narratives if you just scratch the surface. So I absolutely love talking NFL quarterbacks. I love the analytics around it. But you wanted to talk about the rookie quarterback's performances in the early NFL preseason. So go.
Well, here's my thing, Mike. I'm usually not a big preseason football guy. I feel like it dilutes the excitement of week one of the season. But with that said, there are some players, and the only time you're going to see them is most likely in the preseason. And for those guys,
the overreactions are epic, right?
They're epic. And this is the time of year. Like, there's certain, as a Georgia alum, there's certain guys that I'm watching because it's like, I don't know if I'll get to see him in the season. So this kind of is the season for them. And yes, the rookie quarterbacks are always a huge story with a lot of hype. You have fan bases having built hope, so having sold themselves on their guy ever since the draft, finally getting a glimpse of them. And the overreactions in week one are that none of the top picks this year are impressive prospects, but somehow the fifth, sixth, third, some of the later round quarterbacks are tearing it up in week one of the preseason and generating some buzz of their own.
But one of the guys that got dogged on social media was just named the starter at the Indianapolis Colts.
Anthony Richardson. Yes, he earned his way. He earned his way to QB1 with let's see that stat line. 7 for 12, 67 yards, an interception. But fans will point out that he had a really nice throw that was dropped that should have been a touchdown. So maybe the stats were misleading. Nonetheless, the sixth ranked rookie quarterback thus far, according to CBS's ranking after the first game or two.
Not to spoil too much of it, the sixth ranked quarterback is also the first ranked of the first round picks.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, I had to process there. He is. He's in front of Bryce Young. He's in front of, let's see, who else was first round? CJ Stroud. And wait, you know what? You know, I think you might be. Where's Will Levis on here?
He was a second round pick, I believe, Doug. Oh. And I think he's much farther back on that ranking.
You're right. We had to watch him drop in the draft for hours. That was good stuff. But yeah, Bryce Young, from what I saw, he pretty much was running for his life or just trying not to get sacked. I saw an analysis that essentially it was an impressive game for him because he only took one sack and it looked like he should have been sacked every play. That might be the whole season for him. Unfortunately, in the NFL, the higher draft pick you are, the worse of a situation you walk into. And I think Bryce Young's found himself in a predicament in Carolina.
Okay. Well, where do you want to go with this? Because I'm looking at the same list that you're looking at. And this was a CBS Sports Online list. Some of the folks at the top of this, like I said, I love quarterback narratives. And some of the folks at this top of this list, they kind of feed into some really kind of, you know, maybe at this point, local stories, but some good stuff, and really illustrates how the NFL quarterback position never fails to deliver. It's like that NCAA sports ad last year, right? The stories just write themselves.
They do. And I, like, my first takeaway looking at this is I start to wonder, like, you see Dorian Thompson Robinson ranked first out of UCLA, came out, he's played two games for the Browns now and has impressed in both of them. And I start to wonder, like, had Bryce Young gone to UCLA and Dorian Thompson Robinson gone to Alabama, would DTR have been the number one pick in the draft? Would he have been a Heisman winner, throwing to those receivers, playing behind that line, playing on TV so much, and kind of a little bit of that Bama bias or even SEC bias that comes with being affiliated with a program that produces so many NFL players? And so I am kind of curious with him. Like, is he the real deal or is he just lighting it up? I do know that Cleveland has made him technically number two, but he's starting in this next preseason game in front of Kellen Mond, who hasn't disappointed in his short career in the NFL. And so there seems to be some real buzz around DTR. And again, slept on coming out of UCLA, a guy that was overlooked a little bit in the NFL draft. At one point last year was being talked about as a Heisman candidate, and then UCLA lost some games they probably shouldn't have and was forgotten about. And so really interesting story. Unfortunately, he's not on a team where he necessarily has much of a shot at starting with such an investment in Deshaun Watson. That is, of course, if Deshaun Watson stays on the field this year.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it's a very legitimate question, right? That's probably going to have ramifications for college football. Is, you know, as some programs become more marquee, as they become the power of Power Five, you know, how can you not go to Alabama if you want to be a quarterback, right? Those guys all get a first round shot.
But also, like, if you're a GM or a scout, how do you not take the Bama bias into account, or how do you adjust for that and look at a player, take him out of the Bama jersey, take him out of the UCLA jersey, just look at the player for what he is and what he's doing.
It's such a funny thing, right? Because I get where you're coming from, right? And it's like, well, these are professional scouts, professional evaluators. But we see this all the time in sports, right? This, call it the availability bias, right? Which is, you know, like this notion that you work with the available, what sort of comes top of mind. And, you know, like these Bama guys have been relatively successful. Now, is it because Nick Saban evaluates the right talent and you're using that as a check mark? Or is it because Alabama essentially is the best training outside of Georgia for defensive players, is the best training to get folks ready for the NFL? It's a really kind of good question. I think it's one of those things where you probably have to look at it as a sort of that check on yourself, right? I'm going to draft an Alabama quarterback. Why are you doing it? Should you give it another look-see? And are you sort of getting sort of caught up in the hype, essentially, of the, and it's a funny word to use, right? But are you getting caught up in the pattern that you've seen from these other guys doing well? But the other one that comes to mind is, what a great narrative in terms of Deshaun Watson. So the Browns go out and invest $250 million in salary in a guy that then, and again, it had blown up before they invested in this amount of money. And this is a Browns franchise that, you know, quarterback drafting woes have been splashed across the front page of Netflix for the last month with, you know, Johnny Manziel. That, you know, do we now set it up where there's a strong contingent that says, hey, this kid's lighting it up in the preseason. This guy was terrible last year, poor last year, mediocre last year, and there's a lot of fans that don't want him on the field representing the Browns anymore. But on the other side, $250 million. It's
sunk cost, you know, Mike.
It could only happen to the Browns, is probably what the Cleveland fans are saying. Some of the Cleveland fans are saying at the moment.
I think what's more likely to happen is that DTR ends up being the real deal, but is traded to another franchise because the Browns are so invested in Deshaun Watson that they double down on, I'm not going to say a losing investment, but last year was, and let a guy go. We've seen that before in football, I guess. And so I wouldn't be shocked to see that, just because it would be so Cleveland to finally have a a young quarterback who could be the future of your franchise for a long time and you, let it go.
You can see how bizarre it would be to draft a guy, to draft competition for Deshaun Watson.
Particularly when you already have Kellen Mond, who seemed to be a pretty well-established kind of like semi-veteran backup. And most teams only have two quarterbacks on the roster. So then you're in a position where there's at least a competition between Mond and DTR. And then do you cut Mond, a guy who you drafted in recent years, who's shown some promise? Do you cut Robinson? Do you trade one of them? Do you trade the starter who's on an enormous contract? I mean, it you are putting yourself in a little bit of a predicament, it seems, in a league where this isn't college football. College football, it's a little different. You can have five-star quarterbacks on the team, and some of them are going to transfer. It kind of takes care of itself. NFL, most teams only have room for two quarterbacks on the roster, three max, but two typically is pretty standard.
So Robinson was drafted in, looks like, the fifth round.
Yeah.
So a guy clearly drafted as a backup developmental prospect. And like I said, the hot takes from the early preseason are almost never a good idea to take seriously. It's almost like I'm engaging in almost like a little bit of sports journalism fantasy here of this guy lights it up and Cleveland has this massive dilemma at the start.
I'll just say a couple years ago, 3 weeks into the preseason, Jacob Eason was leading the NFL in passer rating and passing yards. I was very excited as a Jacob Eason fan. Never got to see it on the field in a real game at that level.
Okay. So what else you got on this list? Number two on this list is very exciting for a Georgia Bulldog fan.
Yeah, I think the fans are having a fun time with that. There was kind of this, it's weird with Stetson, because when he was a player, a lot of the fans were like, you know, why were we giving a scholarship to this guy? He should be a walk-on. You know, he shouldn't be on the team.
Doug, why were you giving him a scholarship? He apparently had no interest in graduating.
It's the most impressive. He's achieved a lot. Going to college for like 7 years without getting a degree is – he must have switched majors every semester. I'm impressed.
And the transfer credit – and the credits didn't transfer over from the JUCO stint, right?
Right. And all I'm saying is if Ryan Seacrest can get an honorary degree from Georgia after attending for one semester,
national championships,
can we not give Stetson Bennett an honorary degree for two national championships?
Doug, I think the only question is what degree do you give him? Honorary doctorate?
I think they make up a degree. I think he's got I don't even think it's a undergrad degree. I think he's got a PhD and overcoming obstacles and winning national championships.
He has done well, though. I mean, he's for a third or fourth round pick. He's done well on the social media side of it. He is an intriguing character. Given what we do, Doug, I am truly rooting for Stetson because I think he's not my favorite rookie. Maybe we'll talk about my favorite rookie, but
yeah,
Stetson's up there in terms of the. And you know I love athletes that fall into this category. He seems to be an independent thinker.
he's in that category, I think. And his stat line, I will say, is a little more impressive than his performance was. 17 for 29, 191 yards, 89.9 passer rating. So, again, Georgia fans were fired up about the fact that – and, again, a lot of these are the same people that didn't think he should have a scholarship – are now saying he should have been a first-round pick because you could argue that he achieved more than a guy like Bryce Young or Will Levis or Anthony Richardson won head-to-heads against all those guys. Of course, his team won head-to-heads. But people saying, you know, he was just overlooked because of this and that, because he was a walk-on because of his size or whatnot, same size as Bryce Young. Those fans are loving it. They're eating it up. It's kind of a we're better than you mindset when the player that played for the team that you pulled for goes and outperforms the player for the team that your opponent, you know, your enemies pulled for. And so it's interesting to me to watch. But what's more interesting is the fact that Stetson Bennett, really the optics have been that he lit it up, that he came out and was way more impressive than Bryce Young, than Will Levis, than CJ Stroud. Stetson Bennett's first pass should have been a pick six and would have been all over the internet. You know, this guy shouldn't be in the NFL. he's being outclassed. He was lucky to be playing with all these guys at Georgia. He had more talent around him at Georgia than he does on the Rams. All those things would have been said, but instead the guy drops it and things pick up, and the optics are that Bennett is for real. And so we'll see how time treats him. Recently watched the mic'd up video from the Rams account with Stetson on the sideline and on the field. And I will say that guy is very confident. I think people who watch him assume, oh, this poor little guy out there is giving his best. And then in his mind, it's like he's, but it's not like that.
Okay. But there's so much a reason, you know, we're creatures of the environment, dog. And particularly his junior year, every Georgia game I tuned into, you know, we almost had to have that like 3 to 5 minute, almost like Olympic kind of coverage spot on Stetson Bennett. Essentially, like if I'm a casual fan, my sense is Stetson Bennett was 5'7". He was 160 pounds, and he was the backup on his high school football team.
And his high school football team was the Georgia School for the Blind.
Like, they made him sound like Rudy, right?
Yeah, that was it was annoying, to be frank, watching those games. And they hammered in that story. They basically the Georgia team had 30 NFL players on it in 2021. The only stories you heard watching 15 games of football were that Stetson Bennett is a walk-on and that Jordan Davis is a really large person.
Right.
Over and over and over and over and over again for 15 games. A little bit of lazy reporting when you had Trayvon Walker, a future number one pick, lighten it up and was hardly mentioned. Oh, N'Kobe Dean was an engineering major. That was the other story.
Yeah, that was the other one.
Yeah.
Okay. let's keep our focus on the rookie quarterbacks. Okay, yeah, so number three on this list. And again, I love this. And again, I just wish these hot takes would pan out. We've got Sean Clifford for the Green Bay Packers. The idea of a quarterback controversy in Green Bay is something that, you know, maybe if you're a Packers fan, you don't want to see it. But like if you grew up in Chicago, Aaron Rodgers leaves town and they start a quarterback controversy, you know, kind of feeding into this notion of some anti-fandom, what a great story that could be. Because while I think Jordan Love is the, you know, name the starter, I think it's pretty fair to say, well, why? Right? What's that actually based on beyond the economics of they want to see what he can do? So Sean Clifford at number three, again, the stories write themselves.
Yeah, and I think Aaron Rodgers will probably also take pleasure in any kind of madness that goes down in Green Bay this year. Seems to be enjoying himself in New York with the Jets. And those two stories will be, I can almost guarantee on ESPN when they're showing the highlights every week, they're going to show Green Bay and then they're going to show the Jets or vice versa, kind of in a tandem, because it's hard to separate the Aaron Rodgers story from the Green Bay Packers. And I don't necessarily view this as a quarterback controversy, but if a guy like Clifford continues having success, it becomes one. Or if Jordan Love has some struggles, it becomes one. So either way, there's the potential for that there. Absolutely.
Yeah, you set it up, right? It's like even if they, you know, even if, you know, Love just starts the season, you know, fans will remember, you know, this rookie that was lighting it up in preseason. And they'll, you know, You get yourself into that battle that probably no one on the sideline wants, except for a guy on the sideline in the New York Jets.
Yeah. So outside of that, you know, of course, Anthony Richardson, Bryce Young, CJ Stroud all had their struggles. But the guy, Mike, that I know you want to talk about is Will Levis. Interesting guy. What was his mayonnaise thing?
In coffee. And then
he puts it in coffee.
He wasn't peeling the bananas, and he was using mayonnaise in his coffee.
So he eats the banana peel?
Yes, or at least for social. I mean, he was doing it for social media clout.
Right. Perhaps. So, yeah, a projected first-round quarterback who needs some extra attention by eating banana peel.
I mean, so again, you got to remember the run up to the season, right? Where Will Levis, or to the draft, where Levis was talked about as either, you know, sort of the quarterback number four on the list, or once in a while was sort of projected as, well, maybe he's going to be the very first pick taken. Then
like,
along
like days before the draft,
days before the draft. And along with that, we had the silliness of mayonnaise and coffee and eating banana peels.
All
we
the
had,
women around him during the draft. The draft.
Right. And there's this parade of women coming through the room. And I mean, he's a second round pick, but he's oddly, look, you know, Doug, and we could go back a few years and talk about, you know, how many of these surefire first round quarterback picks pan out, right? We've now seen the data on the Trevor Lawrence, Fields, Trey Lance, a lot of the data for that class. But, you know, the question is, you know, of this sort of first group of quarterbacks, which and we'll include Levis in that, you know, odds are we're not going to see four Pro Bowl type players. And so, you know, Levis is my early favorite simply because of, you know, what he's done off the field.
Levis is another one. If he played at Alabama and won 11 games and
okay,
is he QB1 in the draft based on his physically he looks the part.
Okay, and that's, I mean, what's great about college football, right? If he had been QB1, if he had gone to Alabama, and let's assume Saban wanted him, how about if he had gone to Georgia? Mm-hmm. Would he have been QB1 in the draft, and would he have made an incremental $5 million through NIL?
I would say there's a pretty good chance that he would have made some more money at an Alabama or a Georgia.
And what would his draft party have looked like if he had made $5 million in NIL money, right?
Yeah. Well, Mike, I'm just now seeing this on Will Levis, but in addition to eating banana peels and looking like James Bond on draft night, Will Levis was recently named the Division I Football Academic All-American of the Year for 2022 through 2023. So he's also a genius.
And oddly, Doug, from everything we saw about him, it doesn't surprise me at all. Doug, he might get one of those distinctions of maybe he's like, you know, every once in a while you hear that a guy is too smart to play football.
He's overthinking. Oh, bachelor's in finance with a 3.97 GPA. That was at Penn State. But then he had offers from Ivy League schools, Harvard and Princeton, which, I mean, I think most football players, I don't know how that works, but 3.97 in finance, magna cum laude. So pretty good.
Yeah.
Pretty good. I think he's got a bright future in finance.
Okay, you know, and look, I think every year or a lot of years, we find a guy to sort of talk about and follow. I'm pretty sure Will Levis is going to be under our microscope.
He's got to be on the field, though. We need him to, like, Josh. I know he gets the Josh Allen comparison because they're both big white guys with big arms and weren't very good coming out of college. And Allen obviously progressed to become one of the better quarterbacks in the league. We need him to at least show in the preseason enough, because he's battling for a backup spot with Malik Willis, who is also a young quarterback that fan base was very excited about coming into the league. And he's got a year up on him in the system. And typically, as we know, rookie quarterbacks tend to struggle and with age become more comfortable in the offense and against the competition. And so I think for Will Levis to be a guy that we have the privilege to talk about over the next couple of years, he's got to win this battle this preseason with Malik Willis. So something to keep an eye on. And again, preseason football isn't the NFL. It's not the same thing, but it has its own little sub stories that keep it interesting. Will Levis, seeing how Stetson Bennett develops, watching Bryce Young, CJ Stroud, and Anthony Richardson try to have any amount of success. It's fun to watch. I'm entertained. I'm locked in.
Levis could be one of those guys that, you know, the stories might be even better if he doesn't make it to the starting lineup, right? If he's quarterback number two and he has a couple of like interesting preseason events, or he gets in for a hurt guy. You know what I mean?
We need him as QB2 behind Tannehill, and then we need Tannehill to play at a mediocre level like he always has.
Yeah, and Tannehill is in some ways, think about this. Tannehill is, I think, generally regarded as like one of the least I kind of hate when the language goes in this direction, but one of the least interesting quarterbacks out there, right? Like,
yeah.
like Tannehill doesn't sort of wow.
It's bland.
It comes across as bland, or at least that's the storytelling around him. So, you know, Will Levis, rooting for you, man. And again, rooting for you because, you know, you're just an interesting guy who generates a lot of interesting, you know, a lot of interesting stuff to talk about.
Mike, if Will Levis is QB1 at any point this year, will you eat a banana with the peel on the show?
Yeah, but I'm going to do it from, I don't know how he ate it. I'm not eating one of the ends. I'll take a bite out of the middle.
Okay. That's like almost even weirder, but I'm holding you to that. Okay. So that's our rookie quarterbacks. And then outside of that NFL news, Michael Orr recently blindsided, found out that wasn't adopted, was actually being taken advantage of. Supposedly, conveniently, the timing of this is during a press tour for his new book. The family's come out and said that, let's see, what was their...
Well, one of the things they said, Doug, was we have $220 million through our fast food businesses, and so why would we be withholding a few thousand dollars from this kid we know and love?
Who we know and love and also put into a contract as a kid. He didn't know what he was doing.
Oddly, you want my hot take on this? Completely inappropriate hot take? Because somehow I feel like Sandra Bullock should have to return the Oscar for that performance.
I like the memes we've been seeing where it's always her and people in comments are always, it wasn't Sandra Bullock. It was actually the real person. Like, yeah, we know. It's a joke. The Tui family's come out and called it. First off, they said there was a $15 million shakedown where he was threatening to go public with the story unless they gave him money. And then they've called it hurtful as well, which is a term that Lizzo used recently about allegations. I think it's an interesting strategy, regardless of what the truth is in these stories, to go straight to that. It's hurtful that you allege that against me. It kind of like gaslighting 101 is to try to make the other person feel like they did the wrong thing when you hurt them. And I feel like it's like on a public forum gaslighting, although we don't know the full story with this or the Lizzo story. And it seems to be that we thought there was just the blind side, but in this case, there are two sides to every story.
Yeah. Mixing that story up, which is, you know, I mean, I think it's tough, right? Because on some levels, of the details of that story, you know, it seems like a complete tragedy, right? I mean, especially given where that came from and what the original messaging and positioning was. And now the fact that it is, you know, ended up in a dispute about money from apparently one couple with a couple $100 million and a guy that made $30 million over his NFL career is nothing but tragic. But then the fact that, you know, you take your nice story and somehow you're in touch with a different guy named Michael Lewis who writes a book about it and it becomes a major Hollywood production. And I've got Sandra Bullock playing me, and I don't know why the mother gets so much more of the attention and all this, that Sandra Bullock is playing her, and it becomes farce. And it's hard not to, it's hard not for me to essentially, you know, do a little bit of mocking and teasing about the whole thing, because, you know, it's a terrible situation that should have been wonderful. And somehow this group of people have turned it into something awful where, you know, you almost reach the conclusion of don't help anyone, Duck.
don't help anyone. I'm curious to see what becomes of this, because the different stances from the lawyers of both parties have been drastically different. The accounts of how much money was received for the film, what Michael Orr has alleged, what the family's come out and said. You know, the initial story is that the family helped this kid basically get into college and position himself to have a career and have a life in the NFL and make a lot of money. And so from that stance, I know that a lot of the kind of sympathizers of the Tui family are like, wait a second, like, they helped this kid, you know, and there was a misunderstanding about the contract. And on the flip side, there's kind of people who look at the story and say these greedy, wealthy people saw a vulnerable kid to leech onto and take advantage of. And I don't know which is true. I don't think, and I think everyone watching, everyone jumps to their conclusions based on headlines and then what they want to be true. I don't know that anyone other than the Tui family and Michael Orr himself know at this point.
Here's a question for you. And we're getting a little bit, we're now suddenly very far away from rookie quarterbacks and projecting success.
Okay.
You know, you tied this up with Lizzo, which, you know, was kind of interesting, right? Because the Lizzo situation is something where you really can't talk about the Lizzo case because the details are sort of so extraordinary in terms of what is alleged. You know, one of my things with the Lizzo case is Lizzo has almost, in some ways, I see a kind of a strange parallel between the person that Sandra Bullock played. Again, I said it's Sandra Bullock is first and foremost for me in this whole deal for some reason. That and Lizzo, in that, you know, when you put yourself out there in the media as almost like a representative of something, right? As, you know, Lizzo for body positivity, this other one is, you know, sort of this kind of charitable saint of helping this homeless. Right. When you put yourself out there as an exemplar and the image that is put out there is, you know, essentially it's brand management 101, right? Both of these people are very much positioned. Are you inevitably doomed for a backlash, right? That there is no, there's no, you know, you put yourself out there as kind of the king or the queen of something, of a movement or something, that it's going to come back on you in modern America.
You better not have any dirt. You better not have any dirt if you're going to do that. And you better hope no one, that there's no allegations of dirt, because allegations alone, like the Lizzo thing, could be completely made up.
Right.
Her brand is still hurt. Same with quote unquote Sandra Bullock.
Yeah. And it's not even about dirt, right? It's like that there's enough that could be construed as dirt or easily interpreted as, or misinterpreted.
Well, I also think, like, it's funny you say like misinterpreted, like people have been pulling clips from The Blind Side and being like, it was right in front of us the whole time. You can literally see it in the movie. And when you rewatch the clip now with the context of these headlines and these stories, it's like, wow, that's kind of a disturbing movie that we were all enjoying and gloating over. And same with Lizzo, where she has song lyrics that people pull out and say, look, she's been saying it right in our face this whole time. She's a creep. Like she's been weird about this, and everyone's just kind of glossed over it. And then now that there's this allegation, it's like, wait a second. The evidence is literally in her songs, or in this case, it was in the Michael Orr movie. It was even in the SNL sketch where Sandra Bullock's collecting football players and she tries to collect Peyton Manning, which is all time. And one good thing that's come from all this is the resurgence of that short from SNL. I'll link it on the site because it's that good. Yeah. Okay. So Mike, I got to say, in terms of the based on a true story movies that turned out not to be a true story, this is in my top three. I'm not sure where it ranks. We've got the Tom Hanks movie where I'm the captain now. That one where it turned out the captain actually kind of, people on the boat thought he had a death wish and the movie made him out to be this hero, Captain Phillips. But in reality, apparently he handled things horribly and got them into the whole situation at the expense of his passengers and ignored all kinds of warnings and got into this dangerous situation and then got taken captive and became a hero. They made a movie about him. Number one for me though, without a doubt. So Blindside's in the running for two with Captain Phillips. I'm not sure. We got to see what the truth ends up being. Number one's got to be Catch Me If You Can. Leonardo DiCaprio. A movie in which Frank Abagnale Jr. is the greatest con man of all time. Accomplishes all these things that are kind of hard to believe, that he became a pilot and a doctor and a lawyer without going to school for any of those things and just kind of faked it till he made it in various professions. As it turned out, most of the story apparently was made up by the guy, but in a sense, he is the greatest con man of all time because he got Hollywood to make movies about him and he became wealthy, of course, through the film. And so that was earlier this year that story broke. So we've got a nice track record, and I almost want to like start a job of just investigating based on a true story movies and finding out all of the holes in them, because This is three in like the last 2 years that have ended up being massively almost opposite, where the heroes are actually the villains.
And again, let's be careful. You know, you know, Sandra Bullock been guilty in all this, right? But
we need to investigate.
Look, I don't know. I mean, you're almost touching on something kind of larger in terms of, you know, how society works, right? Like when I talk to journalists, I am well aware that typically the journalist is not talking to me because they're looking for an angle to write about some, you know, LIV Golf or, you know, the NBA or, you know, whatever. That they've got an angle that they want to, a story that they want to tell, and they're looking for supporting material to get there. And I think that's, you know, that's a tough thing to get your head around, right? That's how the world works. That people want to tell the stories, they've got the narrative in mind, and then they're sort of building the case to get there. So again, you don't want to impugn anyone's, you know, integrity on this stuff, but, you know, I want to tell a great story about, you know, piracy, modern day pirates, right? Or I want to tell this great story about this couple helping this homeless kid. And, you know, sometimes the truth may not be a good enough story, perhaps.
Yeah. And I think like there might be a based on a true story Doug Battle movie that comes out one day where I have this great NFL career, win a couple Super Bowls for the Giants, and, you know, it'll be based on a true story. Like, it'll be based on me and my personality and the things that interest me and stuff. And so I think like it's gotten to a point with based on a true story where it's almost entirely make believe or kind of sensationalized version.
This is something that, you know, and you can sort of tell me, boy, this is boring, but, you know, one of the things that's happening in academia at the moment, and this has actually gotten big enough that it's crossed over a little bit into the real media. There are a couple of scandals out there where profile faculty in business schools at Duke and Harvard, in fact, who are known for studying dishonesty, now basically been busted in terms of faking the data. I mean, you know, it really, you know, it's Matrix kind of stuff in terms of, you know, what are we actually looking at? So, you know, I do think, you know, and look, you can make a case that all of this is the same thing. The faculty members that are, you know, making up data, they're building the story, and that story wraps around their brand. You know, the story that Michael Lewis, the other one, told about, you know, the Michael Orr, you know, the stories are, you know, it's easy to sort of get caught up into, and again, you know, in some ways, does it even matter, right? These kind of sort of fictionalized accounts that start from some point, you know, probably be beyond, I don't have a final judgment on this stuff.
Well, I got one more thing. Like, if we rank the biggest losers of based on a true story movies of the group that I just mentioned, Michael Orr, without a doubt, last place, like, or first place, I guess, biggest loser. And you talk about a guy that actually was an All-American in high school, whereas they had him trained by a 5-year-old in the movie to play football, and he was completely physically incapable until this 5-year-old came to his rescue. A guy who didn't seem to be able to read and write in the movie was actually an intelligent person, had never seen a bed before, and in fact had lived in a bed his entire life, and then was, you know, kind of portrayed as this big doofus almost in the film. Whereas on the flip side, Frank Abagnale Jr., who didn't accomplish half the things he accomplished in the movie in real life, was played by Leonardo DiCaprio, was this womanizer, billionaire, like basically Wolf of Wall Street minus some of the illicit activities. And then, of course, the family, the Tuohys, got to be played by Sandra Bullock and Tim McGraw. And then we got Captain Phillips getting played by Tom Hanks and being made out to be a hero. So anyway, all that to say is that Michael Orr did get robbed in that movie. And it seems like, you know, that story's yet to be completed. And maybe one day we'll have a movie I think there's going to be a movie about how Frank Abagnale tricks movie studios into making a movie about Frank Abagnale being a con artist. And I think we may also have a movie about how they made a movie about Michael Orr that wasn't true. And here's the real story, the real side.
Look, absolutely. Right. And again, you start to feel like you're Alice in Wonderland through the looking glass, right? It's a, you know, a movie about a movie based on a book that was, you know, kind of a little bit off, but hey, modern American culture. I get, you know, maybe we're a little chaotic here. Doug's fine. I'm a little chaotic today. You know, it's like the stream of consciousness. Worst ad out there right now that has a focus on athletes, Subway. And their insistence on saying, well, Steph Curry and, you know, I think someone have else, they, but have, insistence on using the word preferred instead of preferred.
It's a little forced.
Brutal. And I'll tell you why Subway should not do kind of poor advertising. Because if Subway does some advertising that strikes you as off, the associative network that we all have then sort of triggers thoughts about other Subway advertising. And I won't even finish the thought, but it goes to a terrible place for the brand.
Well, Subway, just to not have a pedophile doing their ads is a step in the right direction.
Okay, but by doing a lousy ad, it makes me think of the past ads and voila.
Have the U.S. Women's National Team ads, they just pull those as soon as they lost? Because I haven't seen them on TV. I mean, it seemed like they were going to be in every advertisement like it was the Olympics.
I'm an American sports consumer. So as far as I know, they canceled the tournament after the U.S. team.
Well, that's fair. That's fair. I feel the same way.
Except for a little bit of coverage of the Netherlands saying that they were running their mouth. And then I think some other country saying that the Netherlands were running their mouths. So there's been a little, but you know, I think it's England playing someone in the finals, but it's amazing how that, and again, you know, the important thing about this in terms of the story, if there is one, is that, you know, why was this popular? Was it women's soccer? Was it the FIFA tournament, or was it the fact that the flag was in play, right? And so that's always going to be the irony of that, the U.S. women's national team, that the key element of their branding was not, you know, the name Rapinoe or Morgan on the back of the jersey. In fact, it was the USA on the front, which, you know, and again, no one wants to directly come out and say this, but that's at the heart of all of this angst or controversies about all this. So.
Yeah, but we went from like the height of the World Cup to preseason football, like football in full swing very quickly when that team lost. Like it did not miss a beat, did not even talk about what happened, just moved on, and football snuck up on us. So and quietly in the background, a little bit of coverage of USA men's basketball, basically like fourth team All-NBA out there.
Let me finish up on the women's soccer, though, because think about this, and it's sort of a great piece of contrast. In the finals, it's England versus Spain.
So Sweden didn't make it.
Yeah, but if this was the men's tournament, England versus Spain would probably be captivating most of the world, right? This would be an amazing, you know, sort of potentially record-setting event.
Yeah, yeah. But the, I don't know, it's, if they were still playing, it's pretty much a guarantee that's all we'd be hearing about right now. Preseason football, I don't think would have the spotlight that it has. But it, this year for me, it's like preseason feels like, it almost feels like the regular season. Like it's been covered so thoroughly and there's been so much interest, and maybe it's because there's nothing else going on. I mean, MLB is kind of, it's that part of the season where it's not yet the playoffs and they've played so many games. There's not that newness, but there's also not that urgency of the playoffs, except for the couple of clubs that are fighting for a spot. And so I think the main interest at the moment is in preseason football in the NFL, games that don't count.
I mean, look, in some ways, it's just the reality of the American sports marketplace at this point. It's, I mean, for me, there's a little bit of sadness that NFL preseason starts. And, it, you know, it's not so much that the preseason is all that interesting, but the preseason, it's kind of our discussion. The preseason starts to foreshadow the regular season, right? These guys that you drafted, this kind of this idea of hope of, oh, Carolina's going to do something. Indianapolis is going to do something. You know, we're starting to see those stories play out. And so, like I said, I don't think it's that the preseason defeats baseball, but the preseason is the promise of the NFL season. And it's kind of sad to me in a way that that defeats baseball, right? That sort of warm up, it's getting serious, because let's be real. Like, when the NFL hits, that's all, you know, the majority of the American sports attention is focused on the NFL, right? So I'm kind of with you, and I'm kind of not with you. Like, I refuse to take the preseason results seriously. But I do love that the sort of the narrative machine is getting wound up.
It's getting wound up. And off the field, Mike, we have a narrative that you've been somewhat of a spokesperson for over the years.
I have no idea where this is going, folks.
New York Post article headline: Native American group demands Commanders reinstate, I'm not going to say it, R-word's name. So now we're like a reverse in how things have gone. Just, we've talked about this in recent weeks, kind of some rumors that the new ownership might change directions again for that franchise. Do you think that having a group of Native Americans that are proponents of this adds any new life to that argument that's the direction the franchise needs to go?
No, I think it kind of highlights sort of how immature we are as a intellectually immature we are, right? I mean, the word, and again, I think it's great that you won't say it, but that you make it clear that you're not saying it, right? That,
yeah,
that it's become sort of one of these magic words, right? And we've got a list of words that cannot be said. And so in this case, look, you know, language is kind of fluid, and the definitions, you know, what a word means and whether it's offensive or not kind of comes from the larger culture. And I mean, so who's to say that from a different point of view that the word redskin could represent or be, you know, thought of as this noble Indian warrior, right? Rather than as this racial slur. And so if the Native American group that likes this idea of having that out there is almost this prestigious thing of, you know, it's like the Vikings, right? Or, you know, the Crusaders, and that's controversial as well. The Roman Legion, right? This, you know, this epic warrior from essentially lore. You know, I'm not gonna criticize. I mean, I'm not gonna criticize their motives. And again, it's like, in some ways, Doug, it's like, I don't even really want to talk about politics and sports anymore. I sort of want to talk about the fact that you can't talk about things in sports because of the politics. And so, you know, I wish this group, you know, I mean, it's fascinating in terms of the backdrop with the new ownership group and them seeming to use the words to try and connect back to that brand equity. I think it's an interesting story and where it's going. I don't really have that much of an opinion on, you know, whether it's offensive or not, you know.
I just find it interesting that the word can be, or the, you know, the mascot can be interpreted as something that's derogatory, and then it can also be interpreted as something that's honoring. Like, a quote from this article on behalf of this Native American organization, it's a nonprofit organization, the quote says, "As the NFL franchise representing the nation's capital, you have a distinct opportunity to recognize the history and value of the American Indian." More quotes are that we invite all Americans to stand up for the dignity of every American under assault in today's increasingly nonsensical culture wars. This line in the sand moment reinforces undeniable history of the Native American assisting the founding of America, with Native American principles used by founding fathers in the U.S. Constitution. It's not a simple left or right issue, et cetera. Like, it seems that it's, you know, can be interpreted as a group that's taking offense to the fact that they've changed the name and saying, like, hey, like, we're not represented anymore and we're not being highlighted in the way that we were before. And I don't know. I mean, have you seen polls of the groups that are supposedly impacted by the changing of the name, what their thoughts are? Or was this just kind of like manufactured that it might be offensive to them and therefore we're changing it without really taking into consideration anybody's actual thoughts or feelings?
I mean, you know, I think you have to, and again, it's, I think the thing that's troubling about all this, like, and we're doing a, look, we're doing a podcast that's about fandom, and fandom, as I've said many times, fandom is about like cultural engagement, cultural passion, right? And so when you think of it that way, it becomes this really important thing, not this kind of silly aspect of fandom where I'm going to go to a game and I'm going to, you know, paint up my face, or, you know, and again, even those expressions probably are not, you know, they're really signifying that, you know, kind of a focal point for a group. We're in this together, right? So these things are not as trivial as a lot of people want to make them out to be. And so the arguments that I have not read the article that you read, they strike me as fairly nuanced in terms of thinking about the history, thinking about, you know, how language can mean different things to different people. But, you know, we got to realize that we are operating in a, and this might sound a little harsh because it's probably always been this way. You know, we got to operate in a culture essentially at the eighth grade level, right? And if you're at this eighth grade level culture, then, you know, things, the shades of gray disappear and they become black and white, right? And so, you know, can the Washington football franchise go back to that name that their fans for the most part knew and loved? I'd say the answer's no. But again, you know, as an outside observer, what an interesting thing to do, especially if they had widespread support from the Native American community.
I mean, I think that's where the effort is right now. There's been a petition with, I think, 90,000 signatures, but within that community.
Then suddenly this becomes like one of the most significant events in these so-called culture wars, right?
Right.
A potentially very, you know, very much getting away from, oh, you said the wrong thing, you're canceled, to, well, let's think deeply about what that means and how that works and who it's offending and who it might not be offending.
Yeah, and I think one other note from that article was there was kind of this notion that they're making an effort to erase history by taking that name out. And when you think about the team name, the Commanders, replacing the R words, you know, I could see how that could be interpreted as in a negative light from that community. And so again, it's an interesting time, and that team in particular and that franchise, and not to mention the fact that their brand value has diminished exponentially in all of this, is the fact that it may backfire yet again, the fact that they may have been responding to pressures. I don't know how much of those pressures, again, were from the Native American community versus people who thought that it was offensive language based on a poor understanding of the culture or the team and the franchise and what that meant to people.
Okay. Can we just, and again, you know, for the hundredth time, Commanders was such a terrible choice.
It was the worst choice.
It was potentially near the, you know, if you're making a list, it's almost like they made a list of choices and then they got the list upside down, right? That could be, you know, lend itself to a nickname of commies right off the bat. You know, Twitter discovered that in 2 minutes. Is, you know, we're in an era where, you know, Colonel Custer was a commander, right? The police have commanders. So it was a name that sort of potentially lent itself. It's an authority figure related to the military or the police. It was not sort of a completely neutral thing.
Right.
So they opened himself. I mean, it was one of the strangest decisions of all time, especially with how much time they spent into it. So it was kind of really rough marketing on top of, you know, everything else that was going on.
On top of the fact that the uniforms are worse, the font looks stupid. I mean, it's like everything they did. It's like, why? Washington football team was so much better than this.
Doug, I don't even know who it is, but sometimes I think it's, I don't know who copied who, but sometimes I think I'm watching Minnesota, but with the M upside down at this point when I see Washington playing.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I'm watching an Arena League team.
Yeah. Okay, well, so why don't we wrap it up there? You know, like I said, we are getting very close to the NFL season, and I feel like I've been promising and been very slow on this. That next generation fandom survey is probably going to drop within about the next week. I'm putting some finishing touches on that. So we'll probably start sharing a graph or two from that. There's some interesting stuff in terms of Gen Z fandom. Doug, you're actually technically a millennial, right? You're the youngest millennial, I think, or the oldest.
Interesting, you ask. When I was younger, and millennials, everyone pointed at millennials and said, they're the problem. I was like, I'm not a millennial. I'm actually Gen Z. And now that Gen Z is making some noise, I identify as a millennial. So yeah. Depending on which metric you look at, I am either. Like some of them are like, anyone born from 1996 on is Gen Z. Some of them are like, anyone born up until 1997 is a millennial. I'm born in 1996. So it's, I don't really know. But I don't really identify with either, as far as I don't
feel like. When we start talking about some of this, you're actually then perfect, right?
Okay.
I can tell you right off the bat that, you know, millennials are the biggest fans of everything. It doesn't even matter what category.
Well, then I'm a millennial because, you know.
Millennials are enthusiastic. And the message in Gen Z is it's very much mixed. Some sports are cratering, like baseball. Some sports like soccer are kind of booming. But it's, you know, and again, it's kind of foolish to talk about these generational splits, right? Born in 96, 97, not that different. But it's interesting how the world has changed so much between those two groups. And so, like I said, I think that'll be out. That should be out by the episode for next week. So we'll wrap here. You know, online home is fandomanalytics.com. Until next time.